Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 104-year-old Dr. Monica Kinneman of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Originally from England, she served in the British Army during World War II.
Well, I had two roles. I was in the ranks for 5 months, and then I don't know how much you know about anti-aircraft, but you had attached to the guns were height finders, range finders, and radar and everything. So I was on one of those instruments that were attached to the guns giving information. And you just worked it with following needles, you know. If you were a height finder, you'd realize how high they were coming in and at what speed they were coming in and so on. Then when I went to OCTU, which is Officer Cadet Training Unit, and became an officer, I was in charge. I just took my turn in charge with the men, because they're all men, plotting the aircraft, you know, because a lot of information came into our command post, all the information. And then it was my job to say fire when they came within range and cease loading when they were out of range. So that was the main thing.
So that brings up a lot more questions in my mind. So thank you for your patience with me as I try to picture this and imagine it. So in that first role, when you're on that rangefinder and you're reading the instrument, where was that? Where were you stationed?
We were stationed between Portsmouth and Southampton, which were our big seaports, which brought troops in, brought all our food in, and only a few of those big ships got through because they were sunk by submarines, which brings back my brother. A submarine almost got their ship going out there. But anyway, Portsmouth and Southampton, our big seaports, we were guarding those. And of course, there are other gun emplacements all around, you know, everywhere.
How long would a shift be? What alert level did you have to be at? Would the Germans only come at certain times of the day? Was this around the clock? What would a shift be like?
Well, it depended, you know. First of all, they didn't come that often, and then as the war progressed, more and more and more, and they're sending thousands of planes over. And at any time, day or night, the night bombers and the day bombers.
So your position would work around the clock?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were 24-hour on duty.
With that anti-aircraft gun unit, and you're calling out the range, helping to inform the gunner who then is trying to shoot down these enemy airplanes. I'm sure there were some successful moments there, right, where you guys were able to shoot down some of those enemy fighters?
Well, you know, everyone says that, but the RAF boys were up there. Also, we had all the different gun emplacements. Everyone was claiming a kill. Almost everyone, so it was very difficult to see. I have seen them shot down in flames, and that's a very sobering sight because you think of all the guys inside, the young airmen who are just like our own, you know, young. Yeah.
So for the 5 months that you're in that gun crew.
I was in the gun crew all the time, yes. But I was in the ranks for those 5 months just as a bombardier, just a corporal.
And were you the only woman there?
Yes, with that lot, yeah. I was nearly almost the only one. I don't know why. There weren't that many women anyway.
Was that a challenge? Or did you enjoy being the only woman? How did you feel about that?
I liked it. I had a great time.
The odds were pretty good? The ratio was good?
Very good. Yes, I never lacked for escorts if we went anywhere. We went up to London occasionally. We went, if you ever got a day off, go up to London, see a show or something. But I regret so much that I just took this, you know, having been a woman, been used to men being the ones, you know, you kowtow to them. About six of us, I think, went up to London. Of course, the others were all guys. We went into a bar, into a pub. The owner, or whoever he was, the manager, came out and said, "No women allowed here. This is a men's only bar." And I wish I had said, you know, "You're sitting on your fat ass. We're out there defending you." And I didn't, you know, I wasn't used to doing things like that. Now I would.
And you said you never lacked an escort when there was something happening, but...
We usually went out, you know, a whole bunch of us together.
And how did all those guys treat you?
Just as one of themselves.
And so after 5 months of that, you got to go to officer's training. How did that unfold? What prompted that?
Oh, well, I was recommended by the officers in the battery that I was in.
So you got that recommendation ahead of a bunch of the men.
Well, I suppose they're sending a whole lot of us to a training. I don't know.
But you must have done something to make an impression on them. Or maybe just your consistency. But your performance got their attention.
Recommending people to be officers. And they picked me as one of them. And I'm sure they were picking others too.
So what was that like? What did they teach you, or what did that officer's training consist of?
Oh, that was the basics, of course. For the artillery, you had to go to a different school altogether.
Were there other women going through that training?
Yes, yes. Well, but then they transferred you out. You know, once you got officer status, it didn't really work when you had been in the ranks with the others. So, yes, I was transferred out then to the Thames Estuary, and that's where I stayed for the rest of the war.
So how different was it after that, as far as the role that you played? Can you help us understand what was different for you?
Just I was in charge then, instead of being just a regular soldier.
And what about any close calls or memorable moments that you experienced there at that Thames Estuary position?
Well, we had what is called a Z battery in the field next to us. I can't explain the guns they used. They were kind of different. They didn't fire shells or bombs or anything. It was a lot of sort of iron stuff, and it was for low-flying planes, I think. And yes, that was bombed in the field next to us. Another time, a plane, it had taken off. We had an air base pretty near us. They had just taken off to go to France. We heard this chug, 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 and looked, and he was coming down. We could see he was crash landing. He crash landed in the field next to us. So we all ran to try and pull him out before the plane, you know, burst into flames or blew up. When we got there, two land girls had pulled him out. They'd been working in the field, and they pulled him out. He was alive. His plane was all destroyed, but he was still alive. That was one thing. The other, this huge bomber was coming back from Germany, and he'd been shot up. I think he came in on two engines to begin with, and then he only had one. And he asked permission to land. Do you know what a tow target is? When we went for R&R, it really wasn't R&R. We were working. We were shooting at the target planes just for practice. So our planes landed on a little tiny strip of, because they were very small planes. This was all it was for him to try and land on. Everyone was out, from the commanding officer to all standing on the roofs of Nissen huts and things, holding our breath. And he had to circle three times. Finally, he did land almost at the end of the field, and he crashed through one hedge, across a road, through another hedge. Of course, the firefighters were all there, put the flames out, but none of them were killed. And so everyone was cheering and whooping and hollering. And then they came into our mess for beers and, of course, stayed the night with us. And that was an exciting thing to watch watch him try and land. He must have been a very good pilot.
I think the next time I hear that song coming in on a wing and a prayer, I'll probably picture that. Huh?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, because that, I think he just had one engine by the time he landed.
You know, I'm interested too, and maybe it's no big deal to you because you did it and you lived it. But when you became an officer, and then, as you told us, you're the one giving the command when to fire. I'm sure you're aware of, you know, how much gravity comes along with those words that you're vocalizing, that there's a life on the other side in your hands, and maybe a lot of your own British lives and allied lives are in your hands. Did you feel responsibility with that position to be the one to call those shots, literally?
I don't know. I've never even thought about that. I was concentrating on the plane coming in to bomb us and following all the information on the equipment round. I don't know. Never even thought about it.
And I guess to try to understand how that worked up here, and you went on to get your doctorate in psychology, so I know you spent a lot of time understanding the brain. Those decisions, when to say fire, when to give that command, was that always black and white and very clear, or were there times where you had to maybe play a hunch?
No, because you were following the information that was coming into your instruments. So you were watching those, and then when it came into the space, then you just said fire. And then when it was out of range, it showed that too, and so you yelled cease loading, and they stopped firing.
And I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but you know, you've been in this war and been living with the reality of war since that time you saw the Stuka come in and the bomb lands 100 yards from you. When it got towards the end of the war and you know that it's getting close to Germany surrendering, were there some things that you saw or heard or experienced that are still clear in your mind today?
Well, yes, we knew the end was coming. Churchill, of course, he was amazing. The way he sort of, the only word I can think of, cheered you all on, saying, we will never surrender. We'll die fighting. We'll never surrender. And that's what everyone expected to do, really. Yes, we knew the end was coming. We had far more hope, you know, after the invasion, that everything was going to be okay.
Do you have some memories around that time of when the Normandy invasion happened, things that you saw in England as that unfolded?
Well, we didn't know, of course, when it happened, because everything was so secret. So we only knew after it had happened. Yes, well, we're all more hopeful. What is the word?
Optimistic?
Yes, that's the word, yeah, that it would soon be over.
And we'll hear about VE Day and beyond when we come back. Dr. Monica Kinnaman of Colorado Springs, Colorado, our guest today. Don't forget to check out photos and a short video with this 104-year-old wonder at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.